almost all of the really unusual things I've done have either been inspired by or crystallized when I've seen something else happening at a conference. But it's not like I see it and then I think I do the experiment. It's like, okay, that sparks off an idea, which then takes months to evolve, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I also think it's really important to know your place in the broad scheme of neuroscience and how neuroscience fits together and what role you're playing in it.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Middlebrooks. I apologize in advance. This introduction is going to be just a bit longer, I think, than others. You heard there at the top, for the second time on the show, Tim Behrens. And you heard him talking about things related to scientific conferences. Why, you ask? Well, I was lucky enough to have Tim on again. One, because he is a glutton for punishment. But more importantly, because he's giving a keynote lecture at the upcoming Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference in September in Berlin. You can go to the conference website to learn more about it, and that is ccnneuro.org, and I'll link to it in the show notes as well. And you can find a list of the keynote speakers there and all of the relevant information on how to submit, how to attend, and so on. I'm also going to link to a video of Thomas Nasaralis, who co-founded the conference with Kendrick Kay, where he explains its origins and vision in more depth than I'll say here. But the CCN, as I'll call it, is a perfect fit for this podcast, because basically the whole idea is to bring together people in cognitive science, artificial intelligence, and neuroscience to get them out of their metaphorical silos of thinking, learn each other's languages, and share ideas and inspire each other. The CCN logo is even based on a Venn diagram representing the vision of those three fields overlapping. That means it's a perfect fit for you. And I have teamed up with the organizers of the CCN to interview the keynote speakers leading up to the conference. So this is the first of what will hopefully be a series of 9 interviews, since there are 9 speakers. And I say hopefully because you never know what will happen with scheduling and so on, but I already have 3 more scheduled, and I'm working out the others. So they'll be rolling out here over the next couple months, I suppose. So that's exciting for all of us. Okay, so today, again, I talk with Tim Behrens. And if you haven't heard our discussion on episode 24, I highly encourage you to listen to that first. It's not necessary, but it does give a lot of the background for what we talk about today, science-wise. The short, quite incomplete picture of it is that Tim has been doing a ton of interesting work trying to figure out how we generalize and abstract the structure and relations between concepts in our head so that we can navigate among those concepts like we navigate in space, like walking around a room or driving around a city. And he uses as a basis for this the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex and what we historically know about them and what we don't know about them. I guess I'll leave it at that for now, but he summarizes 2 of his recent works today, one about a model that uses those principles to capture the kinds of neuronal activity found in the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex while performing the abstractions and generalizations that I just mentioned. And another of his works that he talks about is about measuring and analyzing in humans the phenomenon known as replay, using magnetoencephalography, or MEG. Okay, so we also talk about conferences in general, and I think that you'll find his insights useful. We talk about the wave-like nature of scientific progress in academia, you know, a bit about what you can expect from him at CCN, and the usual tangents I often take. Show notes are at braininspired.co/podcast/35. If you find the show valuable, you can find out how to support it for almost nothing via Patreon. Just go to braininspired.co. Edward, Kevin, Charlie, Alex, and Ben, thank you for your support. Guys, let's all meet at CCN so you can tell me to stop playing guitar and singing midway through the episodes like I plan to do soon. A little foreshadowing. Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. Please enjoy the good sport, quite English, and brilliant Tim Behrens. All right, welcome back, Tim.
Hi. Nice to be back. Thanks for having me. Good to be back in this situation.
Oh, yeah, good. I had you on the show. I just saw on Skype. It was 4 months ago, which was episode 24.
As you can guess by the speed of things in research, I've done loads and loads of exciting new things since then.
Oh, well, actually. Oh, he's modest, folks. He's modest. So, Tim, I have, as you know, I've teamed up with the folks at the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference to interview the keynote speakers that will be talking in September in 2019 in Berlin. And, you know, when we made this sort of agreement, they sent me the list of the keynote speakers, and I see that you're on it. And I think, oh, good God, I got to talk to this guy again? Yeah, didn't he already do enough damage on my show the first time?
First time, yeah. Okay, good. Let's move on.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, between like recording each episode and editing each episode, I really don't get a chance to listen to the final edited version. And it's kind of torture to listen to myself, actually. But in preparation for this, I did listen to our episode. And I really thought, wow, this is fantastic. I'm so glad I do this show.
Well, I've listened to a lot of the rest of this. Since then, I've listened to a lot of the rest of this podcast, and I quite often listen to them on my journey to work, and I've learned a lot. So I think it's great, too.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Anyway, the last time you were on, we talked about the history of place cells and grid cells in hippocampal regions of the brain, and your work on cognitive maps and the structure and relations between abstract concepts. At one point, you even licked your nose, and if I remember correctly, your tongue got stuck in your nostril, and that's why we had to stop talking that day.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I see you've gotten it out, so that's good. I'm happy about that.
Well, there's still some remnants there, I think.
Boy, I'm glad we're video conferencing. I'm not in the same room.
Okay.
But you have been really busy since we talked. So how's it going in general?
Good, yeah. I'm still alive. I've still got some children, and so most of it's good. Yeah. Seems like the group's got some new things to say, or at least might do sometime in the next 2 years. We've got some results that we might have to write about, so that's good.
Is this the busiest that you've ever felt? And you know, yeah. It is. Is this the most productive stretch of your career thus far? I know that you have a long history, you know, with value-based decisions.
Basically, I can do one thing at once. And so, like, normally we go through these waves and you spend a long time working on an idea and everyone's working on that idea. And then something sort of clicks into place. And so no one's writing. And then suddenly things click into place. You understand how to think about the problem, how to analyze data. And then lots of things click into place. And then you have a lot of papers to write. And then if it all works well, then you go through a period of writing grants, and then you get a chance to think of something else, some other idea. And so, I think it is kind of noticeable in my, just in my publication record that it's periodic. Basically, nothing so far in 2019, and then there's several things in the pipeline now, one of which is in press, and then one's on archive and was in NIPS last year, and we're writing a journal article about it, and then there's quite a lot of other things in the writing phase at the moment. They're all on this idea about how structure is represented and abstracted and applied to new situations in reinforcement learning, cognitive mapping, et cetera, and I think everybody in the group has been working on that in different species or in theory or in and different types of data. And so, yeah, you're going to see a bunch of papers at least written, whether accepted or not, over the next year or so. We're coming to the stage where we understand something about this problem now. And then I guess you'll see 5 years of nothing from me again, and then maybe, maybe something else.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. If you, with the wave metaphor, if you're just short of the crest and you'll be surfing down in the next year, or, you know, how, what's that, you know, where you are on the wave?
We're writing. I haven't written any data papers for 3 years, really. Yeah. I wrote a big review last year, which sort of previewed the kind of data paper I was going to write this year. There's currently 4 theory and data papers being written in the lab, and there will be a couple more this year as well, and then maybe I can write a thing for a decade after that or whatever. That's how it works. Yeah, I mean, like, somehow it fits in with the grant cycle somehow, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the whole, I don't know, maybe other people have different experiences of academia to me, but that's how it's always worked with me.
One of the minor, actually, reasons why I retired from academia is that when I was a grad student, I felt pretty busy. And then, you know, people, who was it? It was multiple people who expressed this, like, I know you feel busy now, but then when you become a postdoc, it actually, you don't think you can get it gets busier, but it actually does. And then when you become a faculty member, it actually gets busier, even if you don't think it does. But what you're saying is, that, I mean, yes, that there's this cycle, these waves. So I wonder if the waves just get taller and taller, or does it feel busier and
maybe,
busier?
I mean, so maybe that's right. So for me in particular, this my feeling of busyness and panic ties in with the funding cycle. So in the US, it is the case that I guess people are often writing NIH grants and there's no real cycle to it. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't really know that well. But if you happen to be fortunate enough to be welcome funded in the UK, which is just like having a fairy godmother, it's just an amazing thing. In that situation, you have to renew your funding every 5 years, which takes a big chunk out of the year. Mm-hmm. But it just so happens that last year I wrote a big grant, and this year I have to write a big grant, which means that effectively 2-3 months out of the year is taken out.
Yeah, you're fucked.
You've got to squeeze everything else in, and at the same time we're finishing off a major theme of research. So yeah, I'm feeling busy next year now, but I'm hopeful that next year I'm just going to feel like I've got a dream of some new science, and maybe that will last for 5 more years until the next funding cycle.
Well, thanks a lot for raising my blood pressure just thinking about it.
Yeah. I'm sure that's really boring for everyone. Sorry, guys.
No, well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm remembering as a graduate student, and even as a postdoc, how it's very obvious when a grant funding cycle is coming up for due, because all of a sudden, you have to produce data. Whatever state you're in your project, you've got to produce. You've got to produce something. We've got to write something up. You know, so it is a cycle.
Maybe it's useful for people to know. I mean, it is just a feature of science that when you get a bit more senior, you have constraints on your life that are not just about thinking about science. Yeah.
Okay, Tim, we're going to talk about some of your recent work in a few minutes here, like the Tolman Eichenbaum machine, and hopefully a little bit about the phenomenon called replay in the hippocampal system. But let's start really broad, and I want to ask a little bit questions in regards to the CCN conference. So there's a ton of work being done to try to understand the function of the hippocampal complex and many of the neurophysiological phenomena, like replay. Do you have a sense of like what you see as, you know, one or two of the most critical open questions about the hippocampus or cognitive maps, you know, and this realm that you're working in?
So that question's always impossible to answer because as an academic, you choose what you work on. And so if I were to say something now that was different from what I worked on, then I'd be really stupid, right? So,
but you know, I mean, you could also choose on what you think would get funding. So, but if, yes.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
I that's probably partly because of how lucky we are in the UK to have the fairy godmother, the Wellcome Trust, who are very supportive of just pure intellectual curiosity. So, the reason I'm choosing to work on the interaction of learning and memory, the interaction of the abstraction of knowledge and how that can be generalized in the hippocampal system and those things, is because I think they're fundamental problems in understanding what representations look like in a cognitive map. I think it'd be really exciting. I think it'd be wonderful to know how those things are built and that those maybe are developmental questions, which if you had access to different techniques, you could ask really interesting questions about. But somehow knowledge is organized into a structured form, which allows us to be flexible and use it in lots of different situations. And I think that the nature of that organization is a very fundamental question. So I like working on that fundamental question. And if there is one more fundamental question than what does that organization look like, I suppose it's what are the rules which build that organization, which is, I suppose, Replay has a big role to play in that. Mm. And so I think that in order to understand the rules of how you go about organizing knowledge from scratch in Cortex, you might need to study, access to lots of neural recordings and interventions in development in sophisticated tasks, which I think is a hard thing to do right now. So maybe if there's something that I'd love to see someone do that I couldn't do, it might be something like that. But I do think it's true that understanding principles for how knowledge is organized and how it's abstracted so that it can be used flexibly, I think that's one of the more fundamental things to know about how we behave flexibly in the world. And so that's my answer. And I'm working on it in my own small way, and other people are too.
Isn't it? It's just so wonderful to work on what you think is important, what you know is important, I should say, right?
I mean, you didn't ask me what's the most important thing in the world to work on. You asked me in my field what's the most important thing. I think it would be slightly depressing if even in your field you weren't working on the thing that you thought was most important.
What's the most important thing in the world to work on?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, yeah. Cancer, maybe, I don't know, or world peace.
World peace.
Good.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show again, Tim. It's been fun. I'm gonna go solve world peace now. So last time we talked about, like I said, the history of place cells and grid cells. And along some point therein, I made the point that models and theory are kind of front and center these days. And we chatted about sort of the progressive cycle of experiment and theory and models, and how, you know, place cells were a strong example of how experimental data actually preceded the theory. And then, you know, you have this cycle that continues. In your world, in the realm of cognitive maps and hippocampus and entorhinal cortex, what do you think that we need more of? Do we need more technology, better technology, more data, like you were just saying, you know, better models, better theories, or something else? You know, is there something that is consistently, you think, lacking that you wish we had more or better of?
Just to be clear as well, so my world really is frontal cortex. It's become hippocampus and entorhinal cortex by coincidence, because I thought I needed to understand what information frontal cortex was getting.
apply broadly to the whole brain as well. But
So I think that if you were going to ask me what we need in frontal cortex, I think I would say, I mean, it's pretty clear that we do need more theory, but I think there's very little in frontal cortex. There's very little relevant data to constrain theory right now. So, and the reason I think there's very little relevant data to constrain theory in frontal cortex is because most of the situations where we know what frontal cortical neurons do are really very simple situations by comparison to the very complicated situations that frontal cortex has been has evolved in. So almost all the things we know about frontal cortex could be predicted by many, many different types of theory. We don't know very much. It somehow, because the hippocampal representations have been observed, as you said earlier, in naturalistic tasks, and because they're so convenient to look at in naturalistic tasks, we know rich things about them. We know the nature of the representation. I think we don't know those rich things about neurons in frontal cortex because we haven't seen them in large structured tasks where we can really understand what is being represented in those things. Often we know that this one codes for value, that one codes for negative reward, that one codes for this, that, or the other. But there's no situations really in which we can predict the rich dynamics of the activity and use that to understand the mechanism. And so in motor cortex, we have that because people record during complicated arm movements. Mm-hmm. And in hippocampus, we have that because people record in free movement across in space. And in frontal cortex, we don't have examples of animals making complicated plans or making complicated inferences in richly structured worlds where we understand the structure of the world. So we can understand what mathematical relationships there are between the structure of the world or the structure of plans and the firing of neurons. And so I would say, actually, right now in frontal cortex, fun though it is to think of models of frontal cortex, those models will always be tough to evaluate without a different type of data. That's kind of what I think I would say.
I mean, do you have a sense of how cognitive science, computational neuroscience, and AI can best work together? Are we working together well, or how can we improve how all of these fields can be more symbiotic?
I think we're learning to. So cognitive neuroscience is both quite old and also changing quite fast right now. So I guess it went through a bit of a revolution when it had the earliest models in there from Peter Dayan and Nathaniel Dorr, who's, I guess, you're going to interview, and Johnny Doherty and people like that, with Ray Dolan. So that made a big impact on cognitive neuroscience. And I think that a new impact is being made by these new, more sophisticated models that are coming from the latest AI developments. And I think that this is a transformation of cognitive science, of cognitive neuroscience. So I feel like it should be applauded. So, I mean, I guess there are, like every revolution, there'll be bits that last and bits that don't last. And I don't know which those bits are. I mean, there's obviously a bit of a pattern at the moment of recording lots of data and then training a big network and showing they match. And although sometimes you learn stuff that way, I'm not sure that always you do. And so I wonder whether that will be a long-term game plan, or whether instead trying to understand some of the principles of the representations might be a more informative thing in the long term. I wonder whether setting up networks that obey constraints that we know about the brain or might be a productive avenue, particularly in systems that have very stereotypical architecture, like those corticosteroidal loops, mm-hmm. or the hippocampal entorhinal loops, as we've tried to do, yeah. or things like that might give us information about how representations should interact with one another. I think this free form of just fitting an LSTM to a task and saying these representations look like my XYZ representations is cool, but I think that it will be evolved. I guess
it'll probably peter out and give way to a more.
I don't know if it'll peter out, because I mean it tells you something about how to compress your tasks into something that can be represented in a vector, and I think that is a deep insight. But I think that sometimes the brain has other constraints too.
I know that you have your hands on a lot of different animal models and a lot of different areas of research, really. But do you have any? And I know that you don't have any idea really what you're going to be talking about when you give your keynote lecture at CCN. But what are some of the possible, very general topics that you might talk about?
I think that one possibility is to talk about the two things that I'm talking about today,
cool.
Which is this model that we built, which tries to account for generalization of structure in the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex, which tries to account for ideas both in the spatial domain and in the relational memory domain that we're calling the Tolman-Eichenbaum machine. And then some of those same ideas we've used to study replay in humans and to argue that these representations that allow remapping and generalization, those representations can be seen in replay as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's one possibility. And I think that'll be fun. Another possibility is, so we've been taking this idea of structural abstraction and learning into the reinforcement learning domain. And so we've been doing studies where people can learn about one thing and that will give them information about other parts of the space because of the correlation structure of bandits, for example. And we have theory and experiments in humans and rodents that are doing that. And critically, we're asking similar kinds of questions there. And so what we're really asking is whether that structure, that knowledge about the correlations between things which let you make inferences from seeing one observation to, for example, another bandit or another thing in the world. Mm. But so we're not just saying that can happen. We're saying you can abstract that structural information and then apply it to two new bandits or new sets of worlds. And so this information is encoded in this explicit way that is completely abstracted from all of the sensory information. And there are these representations in both neurons of mice and in representations in fMRI, in all of our favorite brain regions like the entorhinal cortex and medial frontal cortex, that know abstractly that two things can be related, correlated or anti-correlated with each other, but don't know which two things it is. In the same way that grid cells know about the spatial relationships between things in general,
right,
but don't know which particular sensory events happen at those places in different environments. The third thing that I may talk about just briefly is we have some grid cell experiments in macaques, which we'll be recording from at about that time. And so it's possible that there'll be a few monkey grid cells in the talk as well. We'll see.
That's my world, man. That's why I would come. No, you know.
Yeah. So that'll be exciting because we have some of these non-spatial relational map tasks that are really well trained in a couple of monkeys. One of them in particular knows this very, very large relational map of 200 objects or something. And so it's going to be really excited to see what happens in the cells there.
Oh, there's always like that one star monkey.
Yeah, the other one's good too, but not quite as good.
Yeah. Well, mine were more distinct, had larger distinctions between levels of intelligence when I always. But do you get nervous when you give talks? Do you ever and do you still?
Yeah, terrified.
Terrified, but what's,
I mean, it's a strange kind of. I mean, like, I get, it's not a terror that would stop you doing something, like, but it's a I get nervous. I get adrenaline. I get and then I'm exhausted afterwards. I think that I'll have that forever. I'm sure most people have that.
But has it changed over the years? I mean, my terror became something like, oh, I am, you still have the kind of the same feeling, but you still know, like, oh, I know it's going to go okay. Whereas when you kind of start off, you think, I might actually die in the middle of my talk, you know?
No, I never thought that. I think maybe I never went through the experience of thinking that I wasn't going to be able to give a talk.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly conference talks, I used to rehearse them very, very thoroughly.
Uh-huh.
And I rehearse them less thoroughly now. Maybe it makes it more spontaneous. I don't know. I still rehearse them. I still definitely get that feeling of adrenaline and of exhaustion. I mean, I don't sort of care quite so much what people think anymore as I used to.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of maybe more honest about what's good and bad about the work. I don't feel like I'm being judged in the same way that I used to feel like I'm being judged. I feel like it's the grant panels that are judging me, not the conference audiences, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
I tell you, I'm that is a different thing. The terror that you have before an interview for a grant panel, that is a real kind of like, if I don't get this, my whole lab might lose their jobs.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm taking notes here. So you think I should actually prepare for these interviews and for my show, or?
So far it seems like you do a better job than anyone else without them.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Man, you're my favorite guest. Have I ever told you that?
No. Right.
So if someone was on the fence about attending your talk, you know, what would you say to them to convince them that they really need to go to your talk?
They don't. I mean, nobody needs to know what I do. It's just like, it's esoteric shit, man. there's no sense in which anybody in the world needs to know what I do. I mean, they may find it interesting, they may not find it interesting, but I'm talking about like abstract ideas of knowledge organization in the hippocampus and frontal cortex. How do you represent the structure of tasks? Those kind of things. I'm not talking about like how you fill your tax form in. You don't need to come to my talk.
Believe it or not, I anticipated this response from you. I have been told, so I was on kind of a half date one time, but there was someone else in the car and I was driving around and he was being really obnoxious, and I eventually made him get out of the car and walk home. But he was close enough to home. He was within a mile. And of course, but he was out of his mind angry. And, but the girl I was dating looked at me and she said, well, you don't take shit from anyone, do you? I thought, I guess not. So my question is you seem like the type of person that doesn't take shit from anyone. Is that an important attribute in science, you think?
Why do you think that I'd seem like that?
I think that maybe it's just highly correlated, the attitude of someone doesn't even need to come to my talk. You don't care. You're confident enough in your own skin.
I don't feel judged by anybody. The people I feel judged by are the people that are going to give me money. I feel like I like it when people are interested in what I say. I'm not going to go out of my way to make them think that they need to come and listen to me rather than somebody else. I suppose that's what I think. I think that what I have to say is extremely interesting. Right? Is that enough? I don't know.
Perfect. No, that's perfect. That's going to make the sound bit at the beginning, I'm sure.
No, it fucking isn't, man. I'll sound like a cock.
Yeah, that's my whole goal, really. So anything, what do you think is, you know, important to try to take home from conferences in general? Because they can be a real wash, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Normally I come home with an idea, with a new idea or something. I mean, actually that is true, particularly from the early days of Cosine. I used to really feel inspired by them when I was a bit younger. Now, I think still that's true. Yeah, I remember going to talks about songbirds and how credit assignment was happening in the songbird system and having ideas for experiments of credit assignment in cortex as well, in human cortex for reinforcement learning, which is obviously a completely different thing. Like, how do individual neurons get credit for producing songs versus how does like some stimulus get credit in a reinforcement learning bandit task, for example?
Yeah.
But I almost always find something like that. It makes you think about a new way of thinking about your experiment, those kinds of things. I find that valuable. I never have been so much of a conference networker. I know people think that's an important thing. I normally try and hang out with my lab. It's the time that I spend most with my lab out of...
Like socially, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that it's... it's nice to have space to think, and it's nice to have lots of people talking about ideas that are not the same thing that you think about all the time, but are related. I feel like almost all of the really unusual things I've done have either been inspired by or crystallized when I've seen something else happening at a conference. But it's not like I see it and then I think I do the experiment. It's like, okay, that sparks off an idea, which then takes months to evolve, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure that a lot of the early inspirations have come from seeing something in some completely different field in C. elegans or something. And then it's like, okay, that can fit with that, those kinds of things. I think it's really important to do that. I also think it's really important to know your place in the broad scheme of neuroscience and how neuroscience fits together and what role you're playing in it, because it can seem like what you're doing is really, really important. And then you can see that someone else is doing something with some particular cell type in C. elegans, which might also be, and like somehow just seeing how big neuroscience is like a both humbling and inspiring experience. And it makes you think, I feel like it's that has made me think, maybe not be scared to broaden out. So I think some people, so I've tried to work with theory, with humans, with monkeys and with mice. And it might've been the case that that would be a daunting thing to do if I'd always been doing, if I'd been going to conferences where I'd just seen human fMRI all the time.
Yeah.
But then I think, well, like, I don't know, neuroscience is huge, and this is actually just like one small piece of it's not like a that broader thing that I'm trying to do. I'm just getting a few little angles on it, and I think that maybe that confidence partly comes from just seeing the breadth of neuroscience, maybe.
I mean, people talk about different scientific moments they've had that have, you know, that have really stuck with them. Like people in who did eye movement work in areas like frontal eye field in monkeys. You know, everyone always remembers the first time they're in the lab and they see the whooshing of a neuron right before a monkey moves its eye. And you could just, you know, you hear it, you see it, and then you see the eye movement. And that's like a scientific moment. So you mentioned, you know, being at a conference and learning about songbirds and what was the?
Credit assignment.
And credit assignment, right. So, I mean, is there a specific moment that sort of stands out when you've been at a conference? I mean, is that an example of a moment where you've been at a conference that has really stuck with you and is...
Maybe. I mean, I like really elegant things as well. I remember very clearly watching Tim Vogels tell me how to make sure my network doesn't go, doesn't become too excited with his inhibitory plasticity. I thought that was just a beautiful piece of elegance that worked, and that inspired me to do an experiment with him that came directly from watching a conference talk of his. Yeah, I mean, so those kinds of things I found exciting from conferences. I mean, that's a little different from first time you see your first neuron or your first clean result.
Sure.
There is something exciting about data that you've acquired yourself, particularly if you've predicted what it's going to do.
Yeah.
And just that feeling that you know something that no one else in the world knows, that's the reason for doing science, really.
Yeah, that's a crazy feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't matter how small it is or how big it is, that's a cool feeling. And I feel like I've been lucky enough to have that three or four times in my career. Even as early as the early parts of my career, I was studying the anatomy of the thalamus, and we saw this beautiful structure emerge from just looking at connections. That was a very, very profound moment to me. I just thought, wow. Yeah. And yeah, some of the work on when I was working on how people know how fast to learn, for example. So seeing that in monkeys and in humans, and showing them adapting their learning rates depending on the statistics of the environment. Like those kind of things, I won't forget those things. Yeah. And I guess I won't forget seeing that signature of grid cells in this non-spatial tasks. So, I mean, there've been a few things like that. And I've thought, okay, that's kind of cool. And I guess that's like seeing your first neuron. And again, also seeing my first neuron was kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had Tony Zader on the last episode, and we talked about the early days of NIPS, and then how Cosine, which he founded, sort of developed out of that. And Cosine is a conference that's still going really strong. And I know that you've presented the past few years at Cosine, and now you're going to give a keynote at CCN. So Cosine and CCN are both really small conferences relative to something that is huge like SFN or something. So what is there something special about smaller conferences with respect to a larger conference like SFN?
So for me, partly because I hate the idea of like planning my life in the future, I don't like SFN really. But I mean, in order to get the most out of SFN, you've got to fill those planners in and make sure you're in the right place at the right time. And
yeah.
For me, the future is like an abstract concept. It's not like organized into numbers with hours and days in it. So
yeah.
I find it very difficult to make those kind of plans. Yeah. So I've never really had a great experience of SFN. Cosine, I just love. I love just being able to sit there and learn about interesting, exciting things about Drosophila escape behavior and C. elegans motor neurons. That talks I would never go to otherwise, but always have some conceptual relationship to something that I thought of once, left, right, or center, or even if they haven't, maybe they will in the future. The other thing that's pretty clear about Cosine is that the quality is extremely high. Mm. It's certainly higher than the average quality at SFN. You're much less likely to be wasting your time, I think, at Cosine than you are at SFN. So I think it's mostly an exceptional conference. I have not yet been to CCN. It's only 2 years old, I think.
Very
and
new.
The reason I've not yet been to CCN, I think mostly is because I am a sort of devout Cosine follower. And at the same time, I've had kids. And so the idea of going to more than one similar conference hasn't seemed possible.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to going to CCN. It may easily be more appropriate for me than Cosine in the future. The topics are exciting. The quality looks high, mm-hmm. And it's been set up in a really, really good way. So I think it'll be exciting. It's also the idea that it's more cognitive than Cosine is an interesting and exciting thing, particularly, I think, because the modeling and AI community are really interested in the cognitive side as well, which historically I feel like hasn't been the case. They've been very interested in vision models and in circuit models.
Oh.
Which is why Cosine was such a good venue for them before. And now I think CCN will end up being a really good venue for those people. So I've got one thing that I hope doesn't happen. I wonder if it will or won't. But I really hope that CCN doesn't just become the human Cosine, right? Because humans are cognitive and other animals aren't. I mean, I think there's some danger of that happening from both fronts, really. So Cosine used to be a good venue for human behavior, used to be a good venue for interesting new paradigms that start off in humans that might end up in rodents, for example, even if they're sometimes those, the best ones of those come from fMRI.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just come from human behavior, but Kosong used to be a good venue for that. And I thought it was really valuable because if you're like me and you work across species, then you can show things that are relevant in rodents, mechanistic level in rodents or monkeys, and then show their relevance in humans, or you can develop tasks in humans where it's easier and then take it down to look for mechanism. And sometimes you can even look for mechanism, some types of mechanisms in human imaging data, I think. That's a different debate. But yeah, so I thought that that was a really valuable thing. And I think that just isn't really available to you anymore at Cosine. I think just because of the pool of reviewers, and because of how competitive it is, and also because of what's happening in the rodent world, with like the most important thing being the number of neurons you can record from, and or the size of your deep net, or the particularly amazing genetic manipulation you can make. So, I mean, this year our lab sent, I guess, 8 or so abstracts in across different species and models, and so. Some of them were rodent ones, some of them were modeling ones, and some of them were human ones, and everything got in apart from the human ones, even though in some cases it was exactly the same task in the rodent, in the human. The results were finished and completed and looked beautiful in the human, and we're just starting analyzing the data in the rodents. It doesn't matter. The human's one just gets rejected. And so I think that Cosine, that's a problem for Cosine in the future, and if CCN take that niche, and then it's great for CCN, but I also think that it's really important that those worlds don't lose each other. That's my view, and so I really hope it doesn't just split down that axis. So that I guess that's what I think.
Cool. Hey, do you want to talk a little bit of science?
Yeah, okay.
So some of your recent work here, let's start off, and we'll keep this in kind of broader strokes. The Tolman-Eichenbaum machine, generalizing structural knowledge in the hippocampal entorhinal system. Now, I think this is so cool that you name the model the Tolman-Eichenbaum machine after Edward Tolman and Howard Eichenbaum, until I realized how much the acronym TEM sounds like Tim. I mean, there's a Tim. I mean, is this some sort of Hofstadter strange loop you've got going on or what?
We thought it was. So, I mean, this is a paper, guys, that isn't called the Tolman-Eichenbaum machine in its published form. So it's a paper that you can find on archives, and it was at NIPS last year.
Yeah, I'll link to it in the show notes.
But we're currently writing it for a journal, and we're writing a more accessible version of it. And part of that, so I've shown Paul where we are so far with writing this. And we're trying to explain why it solves problems that were introduced by Tolman and Eichenbaum in a way that that also produces the famous spatial representations that have been measured by like O'Keefe and the Moses. There's three nods in that title. I don't know whether Paul noticed the last nod, but there's a nod to the fact that Tolman invented the idea of cognitive maps and when he did so, he wasn't just talking about space. He was talking about a systematic organization of knowledge that would cover all of life. And there's a nod to the fact that Eichenbaum and colleagues have related that to the idea of relational memory, the idea that you can form representations of memories as a way of providing that organization of knowledge. And the third nod is to the way that the machine works and the level of abstraction, which is very much related to how the Helmholtz machine works from Peter Diane and Jeff Hinton and Terry Sanofsky, and how the sleep-wake algorithm works with learning generative models and replaying from those generative models to learn recognition models. So it's a bit like a version of the Helmholtz machine, but one that learns to control hippocampal-like memory so that it learns how to build relational memories, which can then do one-shot memories, so it can remember things straight away. But because they're relational memories that know about the structure of the world, like the Helmholtz machine does a bit, they can also make inferences in zero-shot about what other things should be around. And so we show that if you build a machine a bit like that, you can make a formal analogy between relational memory and space, So that really formalizes that. And this idea of understanding the structure of the relationships and abstracting the structure of the relationships is one of the reasons you can do that. And the second thing that I think is cool about it is that if you make a machine that learns these problems, then in these relational memory style problems, it learns how to do transitive inference, or it learns how to, it can navigate social graphs. So it knows that your brother's father is your father, but your father's brother is your uncle, and those kinds of things. And so it can make predictions about who on those kind of relational graphs. But also it can learn spatial graphs. And when it does so, it can account for a lot of the types of representations that we see in hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. So, for example, it can produce grid cells and place cells, but critically, it can account for what happens when they remap across environments, for example. So there are really interesting properties for how place cells appear to reorganize themselves, just randomly reorganize themselves, so that neighbors in one environment are not neighbors in another environment. But grid cells don't. They seem to just reorient. So they keep the same relational structure, which means they can impose this structural knowledge on the new hippocampal map. And so those kinds of things happen in the Tolman Eichenbaum machine. It accounts for remapping really nicely.
Has it been thought that remapping occurs randomly? And this sort of shows that it's not random, that it does keep the structural integrity?
So I'll get to that in a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the other types of thing that you can account for example, are all of these other types of cells that are recorded in the that tend to be recorded in the system. Like, for example, boundary cells or band cells, even these recent things like object vector cells that were recently in Nature from the Moser group. And so you can show that even though if you're trying to figure out what the next thing is, if you're trying to predict the next thing you'll see, then if you're just randomly moving around, then you need grid cells to do that. But if you start assuming that your machine is a bit like a mouse or a rat, and so it likes, for example, walking around walls, or it likes approaching objects, then that changes the transition structure of the world. And in order to build representations of those of those new transition structures, you need things like object vector cells and band cells and boundary cells and those kinds of stuff. So it can start, I think, to account in one framework for lots of cell types that have been recorded in the entorhinal cortex and hippocampus, but also what happens when you try to generalize that knowledge from one place to another. And the last thing that it does, as you were saying, is in order to do this, it makes predictions for a very particular way in which this structural information is transferred between the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex. The entorhinal cortex to the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. And so we can go and record that in a couple of different data sets now. So we can record, we can show that this remapping isn't truly random. And so information about the structural relationships is preserved between the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus, but instead of neighboring place cells in one world moving to neighboring places in another world, what they'll do is they'll move to another peak of the same grid cell, basically, and so that preserves all the structural information that's present in the grid cells, but makes it look as though they randomly reshuffle. So that's a prediction that's made from the model, and that's held up in some data. Those are the kinds of things we're saying in the paper. Maybe that's too much detail.
No, you just ran through all my questions and answered them all pretty much. So,
well, okay, sorry.
No, that's great. Well, so I have actually only two more questions about it. One is, I know it's a work in progress, a manuscript in progress, but there's a notion in there that it could benefit AI systems, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of how something like the Tolman Eichenbaum machine might benefit AI systems.
Well, what it does is abstract stuff. It abstracts structural knowledge about tasks.
So one of the problems with AI these days is that it takes forever to learn. So these are super, you know, the deep learning nets are supervised learning mechanisms, and they start off as tabula rasas. So, and you can't transfer learning is, there's a lot of work on transfer learning, which is taking a neural net and then trying to, on one task and trying to learn a new task. Is that something, would the generalization and the abstraction help in transfer learning, for instance?
So, I mean, the idea is to explain how abstract knowledge is transferred to constrain new representations in our brain.
Yep.
I think that this problem of transfer learning and abstraction are too big. These problems are big open problems in AI. I don't know whether these are the best solutions to those problems, and other people work on those problems too.
Yeah.
I think they're interesting solutions, and I think that the fact that they predict the representations that we can measure in the brain will be of interest to people that study these problems in AI. I think that relational memory is not usually used in AI. So people who use memory systems in AI tend to use random access memories. Even the people that are doing episodic meta learning, those kinds of things, tend to use random access memories. And these content addressable relational memories, I think, that contain knowledge about the relationship between every event and every other event, I think that might be an interesting avenue for AI. I don't by any means think that this the machines that we have built are solving problems that the AI people can't solve in other ways.
Right.
It's not built for that reason. It's built to try to understand how the hippocampal system solves the problem.
Yeah.
But it's definitely also the case that James Whittington, who built this lovely model, I should have mentioned that earlier, and all these ideas are his, really. So he is about to start at DeepMind. I don't think that he'll have to start thinking all over again.
Yeah, that's basically what I think. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is that's a really good overview. And again, I'll point people to the manuscript that's available on, is it Archive or BioArchive?
So there's two manuscripts available online showing it. They're both, so I apologize to everybody that they're both very technical so far, the ones that are available online. Yeah. There is an Archive paper, which was also a paper at NIPS 2018. So we now have a draft manuscript that's much easier to understand, yeah. But I guess it won't be submitted for a month or so, and therefore it'll start its process. It might end up on BioArchive at some stage before that.
I see. Okay. So is it? You think it's time to say Bob's your uncle on this one?
Bob's what?
Oh, yeah, see, right. I see. Did you bury that? Yeah. You did bite on it. Was that intentional? So you put the relational. Work.
Yeah, that might be James's joke that I've missed.
Is it James's joke? Oh, okay. So you guys will have to, when the manuscript does come out, you'll have to look up to see if you can.
I realize what you're talking about now, and I suspect that's a joke that James put in his. So Paul is talking about a graph in our manuscript, which is a family tree in which Bob is someone's uncle. And I'm afraid so far missed out on that hilarity that James has put in there for us.
Oh, gosh. Well, James, I hope I didn't get you in trouble there, you know. So well done, though, James. I got it. Okay, well, so let's take a few minutes to talk about Replay. This is a manuscript you have in press at Cell called Human Replay Spontaneously Reorganizes Experience. So replay as a phenomenon has been associated with a lot of different putative roles, right? Like systems memory consolidation, navigational planning, reinforcement learning, you know, working memory, recall. But it was originally discovered in sleeping, I don't know if it was mice or rats, but it was rodents after having run around mazes. Mm-hmm. What is replay and how has the interpretation of it changed since its discovery?
So replay is representations that are measured during experience, then are recapitulated during rest much faster than they were experienced. Often this happens often these are recorded in the hippocampus, although I don't think there's any reason to think that they only exist in the hippocampus. And often they happen during these events called shortwave ripples, in which there is a lot of very high frequency power expressed in the LFP of the hippocampal LFP. And you get this big ripple, and at the same time, you get place cells activating, and they activate in a particular sequence, which is a meaningful sequence given the previous activation of cells when the animal was running on the track. And so given some memory that you've had of running on the track is now being reactivated at the time it was sleep, but also it happens in waking rest. That's why people thought that it was important for memory consolidation. I guess there's evidence for that. More recently, there have been evidence of playing out trajectories that where pieces of the trajectory have been experienced before, but separately. And so they, you might, one day you might run down one route and then and not turn off it to the right. And then a different day you might run down the another route at a crossroads, across the other way across the crossroads. And then you might replay the sort of right turn that you never made, right? And so to say, okay, what would it be like to go down down there? And so that's brought up, those kinds of results have brought up this idea that directly replaying experience might be sampling from a generative model of how you think the world works. And obviously your experience is what you use to build that generative model. But you can also, but you don't just have to play your experiences, because you can also use your all this prior knowledge you have about how the world works, and that I've been talking about with the organization of knowledge, to build these interesting generative models of how the world works. And so that's the kind of recent idea. And we have been doing work along those lines. But I think the way in the paper that you're about to see, that we're about to talk about, I think it's a pretty dramatic reorganization of experience. And it's in humans, and it's non-spatial. And so that those three things make it interesting, because if this replay is really there in arbitrary non-spatial tasks, it can maybe underlie some pretty profound abstractions and models that we think about that are different from ones that rodents have.
Yeah, so traditionally replay has been studied and measured in rodents.
With place cells in space, yeah.
Yeah, and like you said, this work is in humans, so how do you do it in humans?
Well, I should start off, given my failure to highlight James Whittington early enough in the last section, I'm going to highlight Yunze Liu from UCL, who's a PhD student who's done most of the work, and Zeb Kurth Nelson, who's at DeepMind and is just fantastic, and also was the first person to think of this technique in a slightly different situation when he was working with Peter Down and Ray Dolan, who've also been involved in this work. So you can do it with MEG. Effectively, what you do is you show people a bunch of pictures and you measure the representation of those pictures in the MEG sensors. And each one of those pictures or things, objects that you show them, will have a different representation in the MEG sensors, so that you could look at the MEG sensors and say, all right, he's thinking of a horse now and a chair now and a car now. And then you organize these pictures into some knowledge structure in the subject's mind. That might be putting them in a sequence, or in other situations, putting them in a more complicated knowledge structure.
So they have to learn the sequence or the knowledge structure.
Yeah, in most of what we do, they learn that knowledge structure the day before with different stimuli. So, and then they can, but humans are great because they learn it in an abstract knowledge structure, not that will then apply to any set of stimuli that you give them.
Yeah.
And then after you've measured the representations of these new stimuli, now you can go and measure. Now you can go and put these new stimuli in these abstract knowledge structures. And then now they have a new model that they can go sample from. But you can play games whereby the samples from this new model will be in a completely different order from the experience, the direct experience you gave them. So you could teach them the day before, okay, the third thing you see will be the second element in sequence two, and the first thing you see will be the fourth element. I mean, it's really abstract template knowledge structure. They can learn these things well, and then they replay out 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, which are they replay the sequences that come from the true
structure
of the world, and not the sequences that come from the order that they saw things in. But in order to measure this replay, you can just let the subject rest. And then you can ask those representations that I earlier measured of the horse and the chair and the house or whatever, do any of those happen again, rest? And if they do, what order do they come in? And you can see that, yes, not only do they recapitulate during rest, but they do so in these sort of streaks, which are sort of about 40 or 50 milliseconds apart, very rapidly, just like they are in rodents. And they occur in order ABCD, which are the order that's implied by the structure. And lastly, they co-occur with bursts of power at sharp wave ripple frequency that look like they're coming from the hippocampus. Mm. And so it looks like you can measure sharp wave ripples in humans, that they happen at the same time as replay events in humans, and that these replay events are able to dramatically reorganize experience according to these abstract knowledge structures that we think are a bit like how grid cells organize facial knowledge. Yeah.
So cool.
Those are the kinds of things that are in that paper. One of the other things that's interesting about that paper is because we're measuring from the whole brain, and yeah. it seems like it's a big disadvantage not to have cellular resolution, and often it seems that way to me, but I don't think it is in this case. So most of replay has been measured in dorsal hippocampus, which has very particular representations of conjunctive representations of place. So like play cells. And so you're not quite sure what makes up those play cells. And in dorsal hippocampus, it's unlikely that you'll see the sensory part of the representation or the structural part of the representation, et cetera, et cetera. If you recall from the whole brain, you can maybe measure different representations simultaneously. And so we can tell you something about what representations replay and what order and when they replay. And so we can show, for example, that not only do you see a sensory portion of the representation, i.e. not only does the representation go horse, chair, shoe, hotel, that the image is replay, but also there's an abstract replaying of that structural knowledge that happens just before a few tens of milliseconds before the horse. And so the representations actually look like play position one, okay, horse, play position two, okay, chair, play position three, hotel, etc., etc. So the representation has this abstract portion, a bit like what a grid cell will be. Show me what the sensory thing is at position X equals four, Y equals two. Hippocampus says, okay, it was a chair. And so, but having access to whole brain measurements means that you can look at those different parts of the representation, which I think has been an interesting thing. And we can show that those abstract portions, those structural portions of the representation, they transfer across different sequences, right? So in the same way that grid cells transfer their knowledge across different spatial environments. And so you get the same representation playing across different sequences in the structural portion, but then they're tied to different sensory events.
All right, guys. You guys can hear how excited he is about this stuff. So it's really fun to listen to. Do you have a sense when it's going to be out?
Well, we're just making the graphical abstract, which they have to do before they publish stuff there. Yeah. And then I don't know how long it takes to publish stuff there. I've never published there before.
Anyway, you guys will have to, if you go to CCN in Berlin, there's a chance that you'll actually get to see a talk about this work.
Yeah.
Partially about okay, this cool. work. Tim, I've kept you a long time. Do you mind if I ask you just a few more general questions before I let you go?
Sure.
If you could wave a magic wand and voila, have a, you know, a skill or a new corpus of knowledge or something that would help you further your research in some subject, what would it be?
I don't know, man. Time travel?
Wait, is that travel back? Would you travel back or forward?
Just stretching time. So every day I can live twice. That would be useful. I'd like to be better at maths than I am. I'm not sure I would want to be able to record or manipulate anything any more than, I mean, I feel like the ability to make clever friends, I think, would be the most important one to have. I feel like I've been lucky with that in the past, but not by any skill. But if I could, if I can find lots of friends that can do all the manipulation and recording for me, that would be great.
That's your job as a PI, isn't it?
So, yeah, exactly. that would be fun. I need more time and I need to be cleverer at thinking stuff. Here's a skill I'd like. I'd like to be able to think in high dimensions.
Oh, yeah. But no one can do that.
Like,
yeah.
It seems like anyone that can do that is going to be good at neuroscience in the near future.
good luck with that. I'll send the magic wand your way. What's something that you used to believe that you consider naive now? You know, this can be about brains and or cognition or intelligence, somewhere in the realm of neuroscience AI.
Something that I used to believe that I now consider naive. I don't know. I mean, I went through a long portion of my life trying to understand mechanism without representation. So I had a number of papers, which I'm still really proud of, but which frustrated me because I was trying to figure out what the medial frontal cortex was doing, how it was processing value, how it was processing competition, but not knowing what representations it was acting on. And I feel like I was, for a long time, I was going across the most interesting part of the problem. And I feel like when I started trying to develop tools for understanding what those representations look like and why, even though we've not solved, nowhere near solved that problem, but it feels like that's been a much richer, deeper problem to work with, to me anyway.
I have the sense that naivete is an underrated attribute for people, because otherwise, if you don't have naivete, you may not move forward on anything if you don't know, you know, about the topic. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, that I definitely think that a lot of the most interesting things are done, maybe wouldn't have been done by more experienced people at the time. I mean, I'm sure they seem like silly things to do. Yeah, exactly. If you knew, yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I know that you have kids, you don't have time, you're a busy scientist. I have been unable to enjoy fictional books for a long time now, and it's even hard for me to enjoy like a movie because I can't suspend my disbelief, and when I read fiction it seems like a complete waste of time. What's a fictional book I should read?
Well, I mean, I also have kids, and therefore I haven't read a fiction book for a long time.
Please don't say Charles Dickens. Nothing by Charles Dickens.
No. What was the last fiction book I read
that you enjoyed?
Yeah. Oh man, I probably haven't read a fiction book that I'd be, so I have read some fiction books recently, but I haven't read a fiction book that I would be anything other than embarrassed to mention.
The romance genre doesn't count.
Well, I've read a lot of crap fiction books I haven't read a high quality fiction book.
Okay.
Well, the last high quality book I read was Wolf Hall, which isn't even fiction. So I haven't read a book that I've intended to learn something from for a very long time, since before having...
I haven't either. Isn't that a... John Krakauer would say that's a big problem.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I'm sure... I mean, I used to read a lot of deeply sort of worthy and important books, and I felt that was an important experience for me. And then I had kids, and I stopped, and I should do it again. I'll tell you what my wife does. So my wife... is who's much cleverer and more worldly informed than I am, reads important and thought-provoking books every day on the way to work and on the underground, and I just piss around my phone. That's what I do.
You listen to important podcasts like Brain Inspired.
Yeah, the podcasts, I play games on my phone, etc. When I should be reading deep books. I think that's the only real time I have for reading deep books.
My example, someone asked me, I get recommendations all the time, and I just keep saying, like, I just can't. I can't get into them. But then I realize, oh, I'm reading to my children at night, you know, every other night, because my wife and I switch off.
Yeah.
And some of them are like Roald Dahl, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So maybe that counts a little bit. I don't know.
You're at a different stage from me, man. Like literally, I'm at Where Is My Hat? That's what I'm reading to my kids.
Yeah. Boy, that's a rough stage, man. At least, yeah. Yeah, at least there's some plot lines. Coming up in your life, there will be some plot lines.
I mean, I will start reading again. I am mostly a completely incompetent, illiterate, uneducated twat. but like, I have read some stuff before in my life, and I will one day again, but I'm not doing any reading now.
I just look forward to when it's enjoyable to me again, or I just want one good fictional work that'll draw me in. Last question here. So I do have Nathaniel Daw coming on the show.
Yeah.
He's one of the keynote speakers,
and
he does a lot of work in replay.
Yeah.
Any message you'd like me to pass along to Nathaniel when I speak with him?
as long as you make him look as stupid as he is, that's sorry.
Perfect.
No, Nathaniel is a wonderful, inspiring, thoughtful, friend. He's fantastic. So, yeah, I mean, like a lot of my work, as everyone will know, a lot of my work is inspired by a lot of his work, and he is a clever cookie.
Tim, it's been great having you again. I just realized that in another 4 months, it will be Berlin time, CCN time. So hopefully I'll get out there and I'll get to see you and talk to you in another 4 months.
Okay, cool. Excellent. It's a regular thing. Cheers,
thanks,
man.
Thanks, man.
All right.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul at braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time.
Like your lies.